Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the second series of the LGC News Roundup podcast. My name's Martin George, I'm the Deputy Editor of LGC, and today I'm joined by Kirsty Weekly, our Head of Content. Hi Kirsty.
Hi Martin.
And Kwame Brache, reporter. Hi Kwame.
Hi Martin.
So we're going to have a look at a few things today, but we've got a special surprise. We've got a guest at the end of the podcast, so stay tuned to see who that is. But this week, I know a lot of people would have seen the Panorama programme about the difficulties Thurrock has fallen into, and there are other councils with big financial difficulties that have hit the headlines: Croydon, Slough, Woking. We're going to look behind some of those headlines and actually round up some other councils that have hit the trouble for various reasons recently and just sort of check in with how things are going there. So, Kirsty, I know you've been looking at, Hastings and Medway financial difficulties. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, well, I think probably one of the sort of first things to say is that we're sort of getting to that point in the year where councils have got an idea of whether they're, how they're performing against their budgets. So we are starting to get quite a lot of nervous noises coming up from all around the country. So we're picking up a couple today, but they're definitely not the only ones. So should we start with Hastings? So that's it. It's in a bid to raise £3 million, because its temporary housing costs have increased by more than 400% since 2019, which is causing it all sorts of problems. It's one of the first councils that had one of these local government association finance peer reviews, which is a group of experts from the local government sector come in and look specifically at the council's finances. And that review has warned that Hastings is at risk of depleting its reserves by 2024-25. So something needs to be done. And you know, definitely, you know, one of the, you know, they're trying to tie in together this issue with housing with what they're doing to raise some funding. Two of the sites that it's hoping to sell. Hastings was initially going to put social housing on itself, but can't actually do that. And so the hope is that by selling it onto someone else, they'll be able to develop the land more quickly than the council will.
But still for social housing, is that the
still
plan?
Definitely one of them still for social housing. The other one might not be social housing, but.
Okay, but so it's not sort of some emergency panicked fire sale that you might see at some councils in deeper problems. There's sort of a logic that this might actually help address some of the problems that have caused the problem in the first place.
Yes.
And then Medway, another council where it's not that there's been any mismanagement or difficult investments. It's just service pressures putting real pressure on finances.
Yeah, and so at Medway earlier today, I was looking through one of their reports that warns of a potential overspend of £17.3 million for the 2023-24 financial year, and that's largely due to social care pressures. The reason this is a particular problem is that the council only has general reserves worth £10 million, so doing the maths there quickly, they can't make that add up, which means some cuts are going to have to be made. The council says it's talking about tough decisions. But most of that pressure, I think 12.6 of it is in adult and children's services.
Yeah, and that's a pattern, you know, we're going to see at councils all across the country. I mean, those two service areas for the councils that have responsibility for them, huge overspend, and it's statutory demand-led services. It's really, really hard to address that if you don't have the money, isn't it?
Yeah, and one of the sort of ironies that struck me in the Medway report was that one of the things they point out is that actually children staffing is projecting an underspend because they can't fill the vacancies.
So yeah, I wouldn't call that good news really.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? And I know, I mean, just to, I'll chip in myself here, I know Peterborough is another council. It had an independent improvement panel appointed, December 2021. I think they've had an updated report out. I think they're drawing attention to possible issues of political instability, a high degree of uncertainty about decision making in the council chamber, and again, council budget gaps in the future. I think the leader of the council said that it was a good summary of what they know to be the case. So it's another council that is in difficulties. But there can be light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, thinking about a council that, you know, has been in some difficulties a while ago, but is moving in a very positive direction at the moment.
Yes, so Sandwell's a good example of that. One of the sort of last government announcements towards the end of last week was the publication of the third report from its commissioners, and the main finding from that is that things are going quite well. It's a very positive report from the commissioners. They say significant progress has been made, and they're now looking at how they start the transition out of intervention to do so in a sensible way to make sure the council is able to maintain the foundations that it's built.
Yeah, I love the headline you put on your story about this. It was commissioners to spend fewer days in Sandwell. It wasn't a comment about their summer holiday plans, but it's that idea that they're looking to wind down the intervention because things are getting better there. Any key things that have really helped positive development, according to the report?
The report really praises the new chief executive, Shaukat Lal, who joined earlier this year. They say that he's helped to forge a respectful working relationship between the leader and the cabinet. And of course, one of that council's problems came around about the relationship between different people and sort of high turnover at senior level. They'd had 6 leaders in 6 years and 3 chief execs in 3 years. So that sort of churn and breakdown in trust at the top level wasn't helpful. So I think just having some stability there is really important.
Fantastic. Now, Kwame, let's move on to an issue that it's been in the national news for the last couple of weeks since that by-election in Uxbridge. But this issue of the ULEZ, the ultra low emission zone in London, that's been rumbling on from way before that by-election. So tell us what's been going on with this and a recent court case involving local councils.
Sure, Martin. So basically back in April, 5 Conservative led councils, that was Bexley, Bromley, Harrow, Hillingdon and Surrey, were granted a judicial review to challenge London Mayor Sadiq Khan's plans for a ULEZ expansion. However, the judicial review failed and the ULEZ expansion plans were given the green light after they lost their appeal last week, meaning the plans to expand the zone beyond the North and South Circular Roads will proceed as planned on the 29th of August. So any vehicle that does not meet emission standards will face a daily charge of £12.50.
Now, it's a really interesting one, this, because it's a fight. It's political, I guess, in a way that you've got a Labour mayor and Conservative councils. It's also a fight between different tiers of government. So you've got sort of London-wide government and then boroughs and county councils. And it sounds like that the councils themselves, the judicial review stops the legal avenue they have, but they're not going to stop the fight, are they? It sounds like they still want to find other ways to really challenge this if they can.
Yeah, that's right. So Bromley said it will turn to Parliament for a solution upon their return from summer recess. Hillingdon vowed to continue the fight on behalf of residents and businesses through Parliament and at next year's general election. Bexley called for a delay to ULEZ's implementation, and Harrow will press the government to give them the power to stop the expansion into their borough. And you've also got Surrey and Kent both refusing to get ULEZ cameras and signs into their neighbourhoods as well.
So it's actually a kind of those last two councils, that's a hard thing that could actually cause real problems. It's you're on the ground. If you can't see the cameras or see the vehicles going in and out, that's going to make it harder to implement the zone, I guess. And it's a wider theme, isn't it, that the last couple of weeks at least we've seen local councils sort of green or climate change traffic action coming into the wider political debate.
Yeah, that's correct. So Rishi Sunak has ordered the review of low traffic neighbourhoods, and he told the Sunday Telegraph he was supporting people to use their cars to do all the things that matter to them. And Keir Starmer also said that ULEZ was the reason that Labour lost the by-election in Uxbridge last month. So green issues are being like at the centre of political issues at the moment.
That's really interesting. So to continue that theme, before we recorded this, I actually had a chat with Adam Lent, who is the chief executive of the new local think tank, to explore some of the sort of wider implications of local green measures coming into conflict with national political issues. So here's how the conversation went. I'm really grateful for you for making the time to be on the podcast. Now, we want to talk a bit about climate change and essentialism and what we've learned in the couple of weeks since the Uxbridge by-election. And I think there's always been a bit of an irony here in that when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, net zero was one of his big policies, rhetorically at least. Yet he's triggered the by-election that seems to have recalibrated his flagship policy here from the government. Yes. I mean, we've seen Rishi Sunak ordering a review of low-traffic neighbourhoods. We've had opposition to the ULEZ zone in London, hints even that central government might start interfering in where councils can set 20 mile per hour road limits. What do you make of all this? What does this tell us about climate change policy and what the local sector can do if the centre is turning its back or watering down its commitment?
I think what it reveals is that commitment to environmental policy, but also, let's be clear, public health policy, because a lot of these initiatives aren't really net zero initiatives. They're about public health and public safety and livability and those sorts of things. You know, what we've learned is that in Westminster, the commitment to those sorts of things is pretty skin deep. And, you know, what we're seeing is instead of senior politicians, national politicians, leading from the front and shaping a narrative around things that are of absolute fundamental importance to the future of the country, they're essentially leading from the back and going for a sort of lowest common denominator. So because, you know, the Uxbridge by-election, it was argued, was lost to Labour because of ULEZ, you know, the response from Labour leadership is not to strengthen the case for ULEZ or to say we need to, you know, could well have said we need to think about how we can accommodate ULEZ better to the cost of living crisis. Is just to sort of raise concerns about it and just say, oh, maybe we essentially, in so many words, said maybe it should be reconsidered and dropped. And then the same, you know, on the Conservative side, this sudden feeling that electorally for them, backsliding on climate issues and public health issues is a way for them to shore up their failing support. So, you know, it's deeply disappointing. And it's why, you know, in a piece that I wrote, a blog I wrote last week, is basically saying, you know, if national leaders are going to be so weak on these issues, it's really incumbent on local leaders to step into the void and provide local leadership.
And obviously, one reason that we're seeing at the national level a retreat from climate is fears that it could affect people economically at a time of financial hardship. I mean, that issue will still apply presumably for local leaders. And I guess, are you saying they've got to really face up to those difficult decisions and being honest perhaps with local communities that sometimes there will be inconvenience or a financial price tag attached to climate change action?
Well, this is where I think there's two things here. I think the first thing is that when these tough decisions have to be made, and there's going to be more and more of these as, you know, the environment becomes more, you know, the environment becomes more challenging, you know, you need to open up conversations that are honest conversations, fully deliberative, consensus building conversations. You can't have sensible conversations about difficult choices, changing contexts, hard trade-offs in the standard political discourse. You know, if you're going to conduct your discourse through the tabloid press or through social media, you're never going to get anywhere. And that's really what we're seeing national politicians doing. They haven't got the insight or the courage or whatever it is to have a wider, more consensus building conversation. But local leaders can do that through things like citizens' assemblies and other sorts of deliberative techniques that are much more honest and open. And basically, it means local government, other public services, going to the people they serve and saying, you know, we've got some tough choices to make here. Help us make those choices. Let's talk them through. So that's, you know, the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, everything is about design. And you can design these decisions, these policies, these schemes in a way that is, you know, it takes account of things like the cost of living. So, you know, I think it was just, you know, and Sadiq Khan has done a fair bit of that around you, Les, trying to make sure that those who might be affected by it can, you know, secure subsidies and support and reliefs around that. And, you know, for me, the most productive thing that Keir Starmer could have said is, look, we need to do more of that. Mm. You, Les, is absolutely vital because it's going to save children's lives. We've got a big public health crisis. We've got to move towards a prevention around healthcare and other public services. So this is not something we can just drop, but we need to think much harder about how we support those who it might affect in a cost of living crisis. So there's all sorts of things you can do around the design, and you can build that into the deliberative conversations you have with residents and service users as part of that process.
Now, the other thing I wanted to bring out here is that governments in recent years, all political parties, talk the talk when it comes to devolution and giving powers to local communities. I mean, I pulled out a quote from Michael Gove, the Levelling Up Secretary, when he spoke at the Local Government Association just last month. He said, "I personally and this government believe in devolution, decentralisation and driving power down to local communities." Yet it only took one by-election for suddenly to be reviews of low traffic neighbourhoods, of 20 mile an hour zones. There seems to be just this, whatever government says about the theory of giving power locally, if they see an electoral advantage, it's always so tempting, isn't it, to actually start interfering in what should be local decisions. I mean, is that inevitable? Is there anything we can do to prevent this and sort of safeguard that space that is rightfully local government's?
Yeah. No, I think it's an extremely good point. And I think absolutely the main parties, particularly in the lead up to an election, are going to prioritise their electoral, you know, benefit. So, you know, the fact that Rishi Sunak saying he's going to, you know, try and overturn or have a review of low traffic neighbourhoods, you know, it's not even going to occur to him and think that this is going against his devolutionary principles, partly because, you know, winning votes is going to be absolutely, you know, top of his, you know, mind at the moment. But also because there's this sort of mindset in Westminster where they don't even necessarily think in those terms. They just sort of think, you know, this is central government's right to poke its nose into any particular issue. You know, there are two changes we can make around that. One is hard legislative change. You know, we need legislation which basically makes it really clear that there are certain areas and remits that local government and local public services have responsibility for, and they're not really within the remit of central government to get involved in those areas. And you see in other countries like Denmark, for example, and other places, you know, Germany, which has obviously got a much more federal system, you know, these things are written into a constitution. Obviously, we don't have a written constitution in the UK and we're not about to get one, whatever people might think. So we can't write it into a constitution, but it can be made clearer in primary legislation about where the responsibilities lie, and that there are certain areas where really central government, you know, should not be engaging, and it's up to local people and local institutions to make decisions around those areas. The second, really, and it's linked to that legislative issue, is just cultural, you know, about what it's expected that politicians, national politicians, can and can't interfere with. You know, I think about, for example, you know, the occasions when national politicians have got involved in discussions about things like how often bin collections should happen. You know, in most other European countries, well, probably most other countries around the world, that would just be laughable. Idea that someone of a seniority of a cabinet secretary of state would like have anything to say on how often someone's bins get collected. You know, so there needs to be a cultural shift that it's just, you know, it's just not acceptable, not right, that the prime minister is getting involved in local decisions about local speed limits and stuff like that. So I think there's a fundamental link between, you know, putting something in legislation that makes it much clearer, but also then off the back of that, there's just cultural expectations that, you know, there's just some things that really national politicians should not be bothering themselves with.
I mean, very quickly, just to conclude, if we were to see Labour gain power after the election, they've promised, you know, the biggest transfer of power to local areas in history, in living memory, in whatever the phrase is. Do you think they will have the right cultural mindset you're talking about, or will they too be prey to these temptations, you know, when an opportunity presents itself?
I don't think they're, to be completely honest, I don't think they're vaguely close to having the right mindset. I think there are some people in Labour, in senior positions of Labour, who absolutely and totally get this and are completely supportive of devolution and are completely supportive of really empowering communities as part of that devolution. Absolutely, some really great people. There are probably some people in senior positions of Labour who hate the whole thing and are quite, you know, diehard centralists and really think that all that needs to happen is for Labour to get elected and make the country better. And then I think there's a large number of people who probably don't even, you know, would be sort of lukewarm localists, or maybe don't even think about it that hard, but haven't, you know, sort of their default position is probably to be quite centralist in mindset without even really noticing it. And I think it's that group, that larger sort of middle group, that really needs to be won over much more rigorously to recognizing that, you know, devolution isn't a nice to have. Actually, if as a Labour government you want to generate real change in the areas that Keir Starmer is committed to, you can't do that centrally. You need local public services doing the detailed work with their communities to drive forward the sorts of changes that Keir Starmer has said he wanted. That sort of, you know, someone like Gordon Brown, always seen as quite a centralist, in the report that he did on constitutional reform, clearly had understood that that model, that centralist model, does not work anymore. Yeah. And that if Labour gets into power, they will be in the same position as the Tories in 5-10 years time of not being able to have really delivered the changes they wanted, because they haven't understood that the system doesn't work and that you need that devolution, you need that empowerment of communities and local areas to deliver real change.
Fantastic. Adam, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks again so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you to all our listeners today. You can see more on our website, lgcplus.com. Follow us on social media. And also do have a look out for our the Local Authority podcast. It's a longer form podcast that explores some of these bigger issues in a bit more depth with a few more people. Look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks very much.